Chapter 6. Well, that's revealed a lot of fucked up patterns. Do you want to stop it? Seriously? Step 6. We were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. This is a step about healing. When I last sprained my ankle, I just sat back in entitled convalescence, drumming my fingers while some unbidden invisible force took care of it. If this were a phenomenon exclusive to me, I'd be dancing nude in the fountain at Lourdes, although why bother going with my miraculous self-healing ankle? As it is, I fully expect the process of healing on an anatomical level to take place. I know too that it will take place on an emotional level. My shattered heart has pieced itself back together 1,000 times. I am aware that in the field of physiology, healing will be improved by following certain measures: rest, good diet, medication. This I mention only to build a bridge of rationality to the metaphysical world once more. In truth, the part of the step that deserves our focus is the part that we can control: became entirely ready. Through the process of steps 4 and 5, we have identified some patterns of behaviour and ways of feeling that are unpleasant and painful. What this step calls for us to be ready to change them, to accept that they are not working. This would seem obvious, but when I saw the role of the character defect lust in my life, I still wasn't ready to relinquish it. I still sought to justify its presence in my life. It's natural, it's fun, etc. The "Where am I at fault?" question in the fourth column in our fourth step will be informative here. What are our defects of character? I found this quote in the book Serenity very useful. As a rule, most defects of character involve some imbalance in the expression of and the experience of our most basic human needs. For example, sexuality and ambition are not bad unless our experiences of those drives are imbalanced or codependent. If we are addicted to sex or driven by ambition to the point of workaholism, these expressions have become defects we must address. Our sixth step prayers would not be "make me asexual" or "take away my ambition." Rather, we might pray "grant me a healthy expression of my sexuality," or "channel ambition into enhancing my private life as well as my work life." For utility and ease, let's assume that prayer is an attempt to petition the highest aspect of your being, whether you see that as personal or impersonal. In the examples I've been using, my childhood resentment against my mother or a current resentment against my girlfriend, the faults in the fourth column would include self-pity, poor me, self-centeredness, my feelings are the most important thing in the world, selfishness, who cares about the other person, greed, I want more, even though I have so much, lust, misdirected drive towards sexual matters, envy, I want what others have, jealousy, I don't want others taking what is mine, pride, I must be treated in accordance with my self-defined protocols, intolerance, people should be better, I say, impatience, hurry up and do it my way, sloth, I can't be bothered, arrogance, be more like me, dishonesty, management of narrative for gain. Having identified these defects through our inventory, we have a decision to make. Do we want to continue to operate within these patterns or to transcend them? No one wants to be miserable, but few people are willing to do the work required to enact change. My belief is that we accept our suffering and only attempt to tackle it through outward means. Even having identified lust as a defect, a negative and problematic trait, we don't automatically discard it. Lust is natural. I'm entitled to lust. If she had sex more, I wouldn't look at porn. All these justifications are obstacles to change. In justifying our misery, we recommit to it. The odyssey of recovery begins in earnest when we become willing to truly change. Not content to rotate the object of our addiction, we become entirely ready for God to remove our defects of character. Yesterday, I went to attend a straightforward and many might think pleasant meeting with a theatre director and an actress. My girlfriend, who is pregnant with our first child, needed the car. You can see how the condition, pregnant with our first child, might automatically qualify her for priority for car use. You're right, it does. And even I saw that eventually, and without being told. I just realised it, like a half-wit King Solomon. I decree that you, my life partner and baby mother, in a 50-50 decision, should get the car. I did first consider cutting the car in two and seeing whose love for the car was fiercer and more true. Actually, I realised, quickly and unprompted, that this situation demanded that I surrender the vehicle, and I nearly barfed on silent self-sacrifice as I capitulated. After she departed, I realised I'd left necessary items as ridiculous and diverse as shoes and my wallet in the car, so eventually took a taxi instead of the intended train into London, nattering at the Muslim driver, initially impatient proddings and incentives, and then apologetic conversational offerings, as usual, steering the conversation toward God via impending parenthood. This is an aspect of my programme, and of course an aspect of my disease. Having first hassled Adnan not to look at his phone or procrastinate and get a move on while eating cold porridge on the back seat, I began to settle into an awareness of the pointlessness of impatience, a defect and constant of my character, which amounts to me thinking that things should happen more quickly than they do, which is an odd mindset, to have an internal template for what the world should be, and then to try and drag the outer world into alignment through terse commentary in Adnan's earhole. It is, by any stretch, a peculiar philosophy. I can only suppose that I am overly adrenalised in the first instance, and it takes me a moment to come down. Plus, I was hungry, and as those material circumstances amend, I open to the secondary but more significant reality that Adnan and I are two men in a car, in infinite space, on the M4, heading to London, that life is a flash of light in what seems to us to be an unending cosmic darkness, that life is a miracle, a rarity, a wonder, and we are here participating in this unknowable mystery. Eventually, and not too slowly, all things considered, we arrive at the rehearsal space in southeast London. By now, I have chatted merrily to Adnan, never directly saying the words, "Hey, even though I'm a post-secular affluent white man and you are a Muslim cab driver, trapped here in a locomotive capsule in a fraught time for people of faith, we are united in our most basic drives and our highest spiritual ambitions." Though that is very much the subtext of what I do say. And in I go, entirely at the behest of swirling conditions and the rootless distraction that I default to when on the phone and in need of a wee and carrying a cereal bowl and spoon from home into the advertising agency that siren women giggle me into. Once inside this unintended destination, I use the loo and marvel at the youth. They seem cast rather than employed by this idealised version of a London ad agency. They are literally playing foosball and drinking bottled beer in their loft-style office, and in the corner, a pair of properly pigmented beauties play on a games console. What is their actual work, I wonder? They are a creative agency for advertising. They come up with concepts for big brands. That means, I suppose, they devise attractive stories and symbols to make objects seem desirable beyond what is rational. Attractive in a manner that is fizzily deceptive. I'm only in there for 100 or so seconds, and only because I'm recognisable. And while in there, on the phone still to my mate, I'm scanning the environment for something to hang on to, for something that means something, not like a person who is drowning, just like a person who's adrift. They are so beautiful, I keep thinking. We are in Southwark. So 100 years ago, this building would have been a stinking tannery. Have you ever smelt leather at any point in its cycle other than the delicious richness of its conclusion draped about your shoulders? It fucking stinks. Not of death exactly, something more dreadful than that. Life not lived. I don't know. So out I go, knowing there's nothing for me there, only young women who I know, in spite of what I read from their appearance, are human beings like me and have inner lives that roll like a threadbare carpet into painful pasts and uncertain futures. Where is this rehearsal space? Rehearsal space. Life is not a rehearsal space, I say to myself as a postman whose accent drags me into the present, charmingly bothers me for a photo, not for him, like, for his missus, and I sort of want him to love me. The South London streets seem like a set, his realness an anomaly. The tannery now an advertising agency called Pink Squid, which on entering seems like an advert for itself. I mean, literally no one was working. They were hanging out like people in, well, an advert for a youth-oriented brand, a Coke commercial maybe, having uncomplicated fun, playing football on a game console. Where is the money coming from and where is the money going? The postman doesn't know how to work his phone, which is an iPhone from about 5 years ago, so might as well be some artifact from the tannery. We do a photo holding the phone backwards like in ancient history, not looking at the screen, for his missus. He's a postman, so I ask where the rehearsal space is, and he knows. It used to be a school, of course. Whither the kid is now, ask not for who the playtime bell tolls, it tolls for thee. I think about climbing the wall at the back of the school to grab a bit of life back, but instead go through a proper portal. When I was younger, when I was a junkie, a self-conscious and fragile pirate, I'd have been up and over in an instant and into that former playground. These days, though, I have a cereal bowl and a spoon in a blue carrier bag I got from the ad agency. In I go to the rehearsal space to meet the theatre people. You can't tell this used to be a Victorian school with the lash of the cane and the gruel. It's so flooded with light and there's some sort of an exhibition on in the skylit foyer, but I don't look at it. I march past the first reception because there is a notice on it which says, Rehearsal Space Reception on the right. I pause and pick it up and show it to the person behind the desk, I suppose because the sign seemed a bit shouty and I wanted to be directed to the appropriate desk quietly. I barely have time to ask for Ian Rickson at the theatre people desk. No sign of Victorian schoolmasters or even Maggie Thatcher times teachers, ghosts all beleaguered. In fact, this is no longer a school at all. Even on the Phantom Plane it has been exorcised, and I wonder about some future hybrid me wandering a century down this fast-moving road, musing half-sentimentally about the days when this used to be a minimalist rehearsal space, far as the eye could see, when Ian appears behind me dressed like a summery person, even though this is pretty much autumn, a definite chill, and this morning I almost wore leather trousers. I couldn't, I didn't have the right shoes, they were in the car that I, saint that I am, surrendered to the mother. Ian directed Jerusalem and a bunch of other things with movie stars in them. He's kind to me, but I've not known him long. In I go to the actual room I've been heading to, and it's all vast, and the floor is taped to resemble the stage so that the play Ian is rehearsing will eventually be performed on. So it's like another room has been murdered in this one, furniture and all, and the police have taped round the outline of the numerous inanimate victims. There are a few people here, actors and theatre people, young though, not old, like theatre. One is a friendly Irish man who has seen me do stand-up a few days previously, and he's keen and kind. The other is a woman. She is young, but has a soft, taut, maternal normalness that I still struggle not to grab at with my greedy mind. She's a human, I tell me, but me already knows. It's the humanness that me likes. It's not an objectification that is devoid of humanity. It is the appropriation of woman A's physical traits to my own stifled agenda. Sometimes I feel like Hannibal Lecter when he's brought out on that trolley to help with a murder that I think he was actually involved in devising, the fucker. I am strapped to a gurney and pale. I look out from my eyes into woman A's eyes. The things I want are elemental. Warmth. Softness. Light. I have to put the cereal bowl down somewhere. It is in the blue bag, and I am not the man in the cab, or the man at home, or the man in the ad agency. I am this man. In comes Zoe Wanamaker. I like her name. I like the late alphabet fusion, Z, W. I like her sprightly hair. I like actresses and their bridled hysteria. All the other people melt off, and me and Zoe and Ian crunch carrot batons round a table that is playing the part of another table in another world. We do the bit at the beginning, the small talk bit. I focus heavily on the carrots during this period because, like everyone in the world, I've never liked the beginning bit, the small talk. My mate Matt told me a few days ago that raw carrots kill gastric parasites, so I just imagine the carotene apocalypse raining down on them while I half listen and half regret coming because I know I'll have to speak soon and, knowing me, I'll probably overdo it. Those little parasites won't know what's hit them. They'll be in there doing what? Maybe building what they call a civilization. I don't see them as evil. I sort of think they might be nice. Matt says I probably got them in India, and that's why I fart so much. But I don't mind farting. In fact, I like it. I think of these parasites as my inner allies and feel a bit bad about bombing them out of existence with chemo-organic warfare. Okay, my turn now. Zoe W. has said something about seeing a Coke can whilst in the deepest backwaters of Rangoon, and Ian is analysing deftly the clever use of African-American stars and models and the odd jarring proximity to sugarcane and slavery. Real me wants to say some dumb stuff now, silly, glib, naughty stuff about race and consumerism, but he mustn't. So instead I make some pretty good points about how 100 years ago seeing a Coke can anywhere would have been weird, and that we are all tribal people waking from the womb into a world of ersatz, ad agencies and used-to-be schools. Is that a Madonna song? No, that's Playground. Close enough. And that Osho says society is just a clearing in the forest. And I like that. A clearing in the forest. Nature, both inner and outer, awaits a cessation, and she will flood us anew with thorny green wonder. And my mind too, just a clearing in the forest, language structures and philosophical structures all heaped up high but built from nothing. Like that clear plastic scaffold the doozers in Fraggle Rock used to build. Out we go for a fag in the playground and we move from small talk into actually discussing the pinter play that we might do. The birthday party, it's called. Zoe W. is very gentle, and that is what I like. I can't take the hard edges of this world. This world I still can't fully commit to after 41 years and with a baby on the way. Luckily, there is a wind chime tinkling away in a tangled melody just behind me. I think in some sort of gestural vegetable garden. And I know and you know that dancing sound and dancing light in myth at least are signs of the presence of a higher thing. And if there are no signs, if there are no higher things, then why should we continue with our meetings and our traffic jams and our parasites if these things signify nothing and are just fully automated emblems of only themselves? What is the point of theatre and poems or schools and advertising agencies? There is no point. But I know, and you know, don't you, that there is beneath the shash of thought and the raw ascent and bilious plunge of feeling some code of which the Sufis sung. Christ was, even if not the Son of God, surely not a blithering idiot coming up with notions while picking at his nails. Whether you believe that Muhammad, peace be upon him, was the last prophet or not, there are evident truths in the prophecy that can scarcely be dismissed as babble. Homeward I go, all crunched up on carrots, arm in arm with Wanamaker, ambling up small streets, scattered with beauties and flanked by high-vis centurions, hollering in hard hats from the plinths they are constructing. I feel liberated. The woman knows how to play and how to be in the moment, and what fucking relief there is in that. Every time I choked down a lungful of livid plastic crack or swallowed the tail of the slick brown dragon, it was with the prayer that they would deliver me unto the moment. And here I am in it. She is being playfully maternal, and I like it. Eventually, though, chivalry asserts, and I pop her in a hackney carriage, and the loneliness that was one step ahead winds me almost as the cab door closes. The world gawps open like an old wound with new vigour, and I am on 3% battery life and not just on my phone. My wallet is in the car. I am alone, like I used to be alone. On the cut in Waterloo, one of those streets where old and new vie in ancient warfare, and you can see the old tracks of who you used to be and who we used to be. And hooded people glide by and I jab at the screen guiltily for an Uber as black cab drivers oi-oi me. I like looking at the Uber screen as the potential cabs swarm like parasites round the pulsating blue dot. My driver's face appears on screen, not quite smiling. How many lit up cabs will pass with their oi oi rustles? It's like a parade. The Uber cancels on me. My phone's now at 1%. I start to sense I am abandoned. The phone dies and it's 1999 all over again. I lived round here then, above a Barclays bank with Mark and Andy. No phone, no money. I feel like a Disney character, like I belong to a make-believe world. It's only a simulation, a drill, because of course I am not signing on. I am not living on benefits and drug addicted. But I am still him, even if his life has changed. The essential self refracts now through a new prism. The new external coordinates, personal and social, remind me. I am famous, he was not. The shard hadn't been built then, yet now it tears the sky in jagged certainty unfinished. I was in there once and it was like a Ridley Scott film, bleak, membrane drum skin tight above the anxious city. I am soon to be a father and I don't take drugs and I'm not penniless, I'm penny full, if anything. I walk along a market street after the market has mostly departed and look for a joint to recharge my phone and think that it's like scoring power. There is a place called Cubana. As you might expect, it's a Cuban-themed bar, sugary cocktails, Che's face and a Kalashnikov stenciled on the wall, and the staff seem mostly Spanish, and it's hard to locate what the intention is of an ironic communist revolutionary bar in London in 2016 because of the palpable need for real change, the need for sincerity, the need for the opposite of an ironic Cuban revolution-themed bar, whatever that is. No one there has an iPhone 6S charger, they're a Samsung crowd, and sadly I discover that I am not famous in that particular room, so shuffle onward in the role of a bloke who needs a charger, not an elevated version of me. I land eventually at a bookshop cafe built on good intentions a few hundred yards down and charge my phone there. Everyone does, says Abigail at the till. We're so near Waterloo Station. The bookshop is called Travelling Through. I sit a while upon the floor and watch the green bar rise like the thermometer on an unwatched telethon until I am powerful enough to leave. By now I've organised a cab and the fleeting simulation of normal life, or life without means, has ended, and 10 minutes was enough to leave me doubled over inside. In the cab leaving London I am angry. I feel like I lost something there and the traffic is heavy and pointless. I stare out of the window waiting for something to make sense. I've lived all over London so its streets teem with a deep geology of agonized nostalgia. I see me 16 and zipping round the tube map like Puck, like I'd invented drugs, tripping the light fandango. I see me 19 downing pints of cider and acting my little socks off at drama school. I see me 20 getting nicked and knowing it was going to be okay, that it was all content, that something would lift me above these streets and plonk me down on top, and here I am, seething in the back of a cab, having been all sorts of people, all sorts of famous, all sorts of glamorous, sensing it's all over, the way I sensed drugs were over. In this cab, I do not feel like the saint I want to be. I do not feel like a prophet or even a priest. I feel like E.T. or someone left behind. I feel homeless, landless. My friend Amy calls. Amy, an intravenous heroin user since her early teens, has suffered abuse that chokes me to recount. She's been a sex worker for most of her life and has spent too much time in prison. You sound fucking dreadful, she says. I say I'm fine. I can't take another bit of bullshit, though. I'm all bullshitted out. She laughs at this and talks about herself, her trip to the National Theatre to watch The Seagull, her relationship with her ongoing dream to become an actor. She at some point remarks upon the tenacity of addicts like me. We keep trying. We don't kill ourselves. An addict friend of mine said the day before, a theist is a person who has seen through the material and mechanical world and doesn't commit suicide. I like this quote. To see that it's all bullshit and not to clock off, that requires faith. Only faith will do. Only faith. Even if you're double certain that there is nothing but space and dumb molecules out there clattering about into symphonic and faraway futures, if you believe that's all there is and you don't check out, you are hardcore. You must really love football or fucking or money or something and be okay with those things being only what they explicitly are, without implicit power, with no unravelling flag blowing behind them in limitless wind, back to before some unknowable moment of creation when this universe's heart first began to beat. Oddly, it is Amy who performs my restoration after the terror of the ordinary had undone me. Her easy understanding of the resident rage that takes me hostage when tripped over by nostalgia, when strewn on terrible and familiar streets, of how hard it is to carry on connecting when your battery runs out. When I get home, I see that it's all real. I do indeed have a pregnant girlfriend. She is pleased to see me, astonished as I am that I have returned home with a cereal bowl. Step 6 exercises. Well, that's revealed a lot of fucked up patterns. Do you want to stop it? Seriously? During steps 4 and 5, we learned a lot about ourselves. What we had taken to be random external events or particularly poor fortune now begins to look like a drama in which we participate. Of course, there is such a thing as bad luck and people being dicks. Perhaps there always will be. But by doing our inventory, we can see just how our problematic attitudes, thoughts, and behaviour have made our lives much harder. List your problematic attitudes, thoughts, and behaviour patterns. These are commonly known as defects. We can use the list from the step 4, fourth column, fault section. With each defect we identify, ask, why do I do this? How does it help me? What do I want or want to avoid? If I do not change, what will happen? If I am willing to change, how could my life improve? Do I want this defect removed? Am I ready to let go? If the answer is no, ask yourself, how is my life unmanageable due to my powerlessness to change this attitude, thought, or behavior pattern? Defective behaviours often seem to be of benefit. They are strategies that seem to have worked, even if at an undiagnosed but painful spiritual cost. For example, my promiscuity prevented me from noticing that I felt lonely, weak, worthless, and unattractive. My anxiety and fretting, I tell myself, are a kind of alertness. I have, through inventorying and sharing, come to see the true cost of these defective behaviours and am now ready for them to be removed. The truth is, defective behaviours lead to pain. We must be willing to let go of them all, entirely. Ask yourself, am I willing to let go of my egocentric, self-centred worldview? Am I willing to tear up my plan? Am I willing to stop blaming others? To let go of resentment? Am I willing to use this program as the new plan for my life? Am I willing to accept that there are more powerful forces than me in the universe and that in this context my motives and notions are ridiculous? I accept this all seems quite evangelical. If you bridle at this, it's likely that on some level you think, I want to change, but not that much, or I'd like to be a bit better, but I like some of my negative attributes and materialistic individualistic conditioning. It helps me to be a good consumer. This is a popular perspective. Again, those of us who find this world a little hard to bear must query what our discomfort is telling us. Sometimes the road is long, but eventually, once called, we must walk it. Remember, vitally, we work this program one day at a time. It is this manageable time frame that makes many of the absolutes that preclude egocentric conditioning conceivable. I am still astonished by my tendency to adorn and adore the bars of my cage. Only through this program have I known freedom.